The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
And I told you I'd clarify the dates. I'm sorry that I coupled them wrong. The Bohemian phase, I think it was 1618 to 23. This is when the defenestration of Prague occurred in 1618, when a couple Protestants began the revolt against the Catholic leadership by throwing one of the princes out the window, and that was obviously an act of rebellion. The war broke out, and the Catholic powers began in 1625 to 29. The Danish phase occurs. And this is where there is continued defeat underway of the Protestant forces, and the English do get involved with some of their subsidies. We mentioned that there was some help from this is when that began. The Swedish phase, 1630 to 35, and that's where my dates were corrupted there. I apologize there. And that's when we have Gustavus Adolphus coming into it. By the way, I don't think I mentioned the fact that he actually was killed in that battle. And he's been viewed as not only the savior, but a martyr savior of the Protestant movement, the king of Sweden. And I think the year of his death was 1632. And of course, there's all kinds of intrigues in this. Yes? Okay, hold on. Let me finish the dates, and then I'll take your question. Then lastly, the French phase, when we mention Richelieu and his real politics, the date there, 1635 to 48, the last 13 years. So hopefully that your records are complete if you're worried about dates. Yes, sir? Well, do you believe in total depravity? Well, then he had self-interest at work too. You know, there's no doubt there was political interest. Certainly, Sweden stood a lot to gain by advancing the Protestant cause in a number of ways. It made a Germany that was dependent upon them. Sweden historically had a dependence on Germany from this Lutheran background. Well, that gave them a prominence. Certainly, they had a greater stability by having a Protestant neighbor to the south rather than a Roman Catholic. So there was national interest. Further, they gained certain territorial benefits. They controlled the entire Baltic Sea, which was a great advantage. I mean, so there was certainly national interest was at work. But what we have to see is that his national interest was consistent with his faith. So it was a studied, measured thought, and obviously one where he paid for it with his own life. So you can't say that it was just selfish interest that was, he was in the battle himself personally, and very rare that a king dies in battle, especially a victorious king. So he was close to the battle and had a personal investment in it. And this would be an area of interesting research. Only a real study would show that. We do know when he sent, for example, if you go to Delaware and you get into the Wilmington area, you'll go to the Christiana Mall. That's named for his daughter, Christina, the Christiana, the river that runs from there. So, we know that from the very earliest years, they were concerned for sending Christian leaders to their settlements. So they did have a spiritual interest. That's not a sham. They were serious about their faith. Now, were they really driven primarily by their faith or by national interest? I would have to say both were at stake. I think they both would be very serious components of his decision, because I don't think anyone could have looked at Germany and have seen a nation, some of the most dire figures say, went from 16 million to 6 million by the end of the war. That's how many people died over those 30 years. I don't think anybody could have looked at the carnage that was going on and saying, these are people that are my same faith, and a lot of the reason they're suffering is because of their faith. And he wouldn't have been motivated by faith. I mean, it'd be pretty cold-hearted not to see that. So I have to say both. But obviously, realistically, no king commits his nation to something only for spiritual ends. He has to ask the question, I'm a civil leader. What's in it for the nation? So I would say both, very consciously. Whereas I would say, on the other hand, Richelieu consciously was not concerned about Catholicism primarily. He made that clearly subordinate to the national interest of France. And religion was important to him at times, but selectively so. Okay, so I think there is a real difference between the mindset between both. Okay, other questions? Well, as we summarize the backdrop of the 30-year war, it's important then to realize what we're left with as we enter into the beginnings of the modern age, where, and I think it's important, even as we took some time to look at the precursors of the Reformation by going back into the late medieval period, it's important to see how the modern age is going to emerge from this Reformation context. So as we look at what happens as the modern age is being born from this post-reformational period, we want to first of all note the devastation that's left in Germany. We already mentioned the profound decline in civilization in terms of the number of deaths that occurred. Some have estimated as many as maybe 10 million over those 30 years. That's phenomenal. Is it that large? Well, possibly so. That's the magnitude of a World War II devastation. And this is in really a late or a much earlier time in history. We mentioned that now the multiple creeds were accepted, national boundaries were established, both the emperor and the pope had largely been emasculated in terms of political power. The other thing that's significant is that Germany, while it's enabled to be a Protestant region, will be utterly impotent because it's subdivided now into 300 autonomous regions, which means that all these little fiefdoms of the medieval period are now operating independently. And it will take another couple centuries until you get to Bismarck to reunite Germany. So Germany is weak because it's divided. Upon the unification of Germany, they have some payback to give. Have you ever wondered why World War I and World War II take place in Germany? This is a payback from the defeat of the 30 Years' War. They had been decimated. They had been nothing in European history. They finally have their day, and their day is one of incredible power and that pent-up frustration of what they went through. So unification and nationalism was denied to the Germans when it was being given to the rest of the European nations, and that is part of what explains the 20th century. So, I mean, we're looking at the modern age when we look at the end of the Reformation. National boundaries, national antipathies, desires. But another thing that's really important as we think about this period, as we said, now creeds take on much more of a theological primacy as opposed to a theological slash political primacy. They're still political, but because nations still have state churches. But now the issue is not how are they going to create war, it's rather internal rivalry. What do we do with these creeds that we have? Now, if you were a thinking person at this stage in history, you would take a look at Germany and say, Germany, the birthplace of the Reformation, the restoration of the pure gospel of Christ, and it cost 10 million people's lives. And the fires are still burning in France, and still burning in England, and still burning all over the place. And it seems as wherever people have creeds, it's not the blood of the Savior that matters, it's the blood of the citizens. What are we going to do? And intuitively, there began to be a frustration with the whole notion of an enforced creedal system in a national context. How do you solve the problem of the wars of religion? Is there any room for freedom of religious thought? Can you have really a conscience that allows you to make decisions for your own religious values? How wonderful it is that now Protestant, Lutheran and Reformed can exercise their freedom, but what about others that are still Christians, but they believe in baptizing believers only, and they are not real comfortable taking up arms to fight for a state because they think Christ says they shouldn't? What about their rights? Do they have any rights? Well, these sorts of problems, internationally and internally, plus even those who say, we support the state, we support the church, but we believe that we ought to have freedom of inquiry. The liberty to ask questions about doctrines that are established. We've all heard about academic freedom. What are the limits of liberty? And so the struggle for liberty and the struggle to maintain social order and creed becomes the issue out of which the Enlightenment will be born. The Reformation will turn into the post-Reformation conflagration of religious wars, the problems of creeds, and there's going to become the idea of saying, how can we create a society that allows us to operate with all the plethora of religious views and not force us into military combat or internal civil war? The Reformation gives us the Enlightenment. Now, we can't escape that fact. That is the fact. What will be the kind of thought that will come from it? If we start from creed, then people disagree. And if we can't agree on revelation, how can we create an environment where we just start from reason, from our own mind? And maybe by operating on the basis of human intellect and the freedom of thought, we can create a new order where we won't be fighting all the time about creeds and values of ideas. There are many forces that are going to work toward that end. And let me summarize. We can't pursue these, but I want you to get the flavor of what will bring the Enlightenment era into its existence. Number one, the desire to bring peace out of a war-torn world where religion had been at the core. How do we bring about some kind of religious solution? Well, we'll hear one of those solutions being John Locke's on the toleration of religious faiths, the proposal that we ought to tolerate all religions. William Penn's idea of a holy experiment in the New World where anybody can believe whatever they want and be free to do so. Another problem that came about, and this was a huge problem, and that was, what do we do with the discovery of all these new civilizations? You remember Columbus discovered the New World just a few years before Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the church door, just a quarter of a century earlier. And suddenly, as the explorations are going on, there are vast civilizations of people who had developed social order, vast architecture, military powers in different points of the world that had been unknown, and they did it without the Bible. They did it without Christianity. They did it without the Ten Commandments. Is it really necessary to have a civilization that's based on revelation when we see that other cultures have existed and developed vast orders? That discovery was a profound challenge to the notion of biblical revelatory authority. So you have the desire of bringing in an order of stability where religious wars had been part of the conflict. So is there a rational basis for government? Is religion necessary for government? There are governments that have existed around the world that have never even heard of any of the Christian heritage. What do we do with that? Further, there were the tremendous breakthroughs in scientific analysis. We know that the whole struggle for the heliocentric view of our solar system was a difficult one. The church had argued very strongly for an earth-centered universe on the basis of certain biblical texts that they thought, thank you, Sally. Thought were necessary to maintain that view. But through the work of the observations of Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler and others like Tycho Brahe, they demonstrated that the planets moved in an elliptical pattern around the sun, and the Earth was not the center of the universe. And it was human reason that had figured that out. And therefore, man was not dependent for his knowledge on the Bible, but rather on his reason. And therefore, reason was elevated in the mind's eye. Very fascinatingly, we can come to a man like Newton with his incredible deductions of the laws of physics from the observations of the planetary work of Brahe and Kepler and others. And they realized that natural law was able to explain the movement of the spheres. And there was a natural law that said maybe the world is not a place of sovereign, arbitrary providences of God, but it's made up of natural laws, that where the laws work, that's what is. And if there is a God out there, he's a God who has bound himself by natural law. Not an arbitrary, sovereign, providential God who intervenes, but if we know the laws, we will know what will happen. And we do that by reason, not by revelation. And so you can understand how it was very possible for a devout Roman Catholic student by the name of René Descartes to begin to say, you know what, it's human logic and reason that explains the world. And he began that famous dubito ergo sum argument, I doubt, therefore I am. He said, I can doubt everything, but I can't doubt the fact that I'm doubting. Really, it's I doubt or I think, therefore at least I am. I've established something I know for sure based on myself, and on the basis of my self-existence, I will reason to a certainty beyond myself. And so rationalism is born. That was called atheism by its reformed opponents. He wrote in the Netherlands. He wasn't safe to write these kind of ideas in France. the Protestant milieu gave him a little more intellectual freedom. And as Descartes developed his sort of thinking, it was a man-centered universe, even though it was no longer an earth-centered universe. It used to be the I am that I am that was the center of the universe. Now it's the doubting man who says, I think, therefore I am. He's the center of the universe. So we have a profound shift to an autonomous kind of reason. This is where Van Til starts waking up right now. If you had any apologetics, human autonomy is coming on the stage. This is Enlightenment thought. And so we begin to have the wrestling match with how important is revelation after all as opposed to human reason? Was it not Roman Catholics arguing over the Bible with Protestants arguing over the Bible that devastated Germany? We got to govern the world. Maybe we'd do better if we got the Bible out of government. Maybe we'd do better if we just relied on human reason. Now, that is a pretty persuasive argument, but you know, we have the luxury of living now at the beginning of a new millennium and a new century, and we have seen what the Enlightenment has brought us. Never forget that. Look back at the 20th century. You know, we talk about the bloody religious wars of the Reformation. Well, you know, that was beanbag or a Sunday school picnic compared to what we've just lived through in this last century, where millions upon millions upon millions, maybe 300 million people died because of ideology in the 20th century, because of non-Christian thought. Okay, so think about that. That's pretty serious. What happened through China, Soviet Union, and the Gulag Archipelago, and on it goes. So the point is, ideology always causes conflict, and reason has not solved the problem. Reason failed. One of the great things of postmodernism is saying, you know what, we can't glorify reason, it's not working. We got to go back to something else. We got to rediscover some other principle. Well, that's for the modern age, but what I want you to see as you look through the worldview implications, the late Reformation period had brought a divided Europe, a blood-soaked Europe, and they thought, we got to find a better way. That better way will move away from biblical religious ideologies to more of a secular model. So as the Peace of Westphalia gives us, if you will, a rational, pragmatic decision on government, with Richelieu fighting on political rather than theological grounds, out of that milieu a whole worldview will develop that says reason must govern. And that gives us the Enlightenment. And everything will be reinterpreted. The creeds, therefore, that we're going to look at now in a minute, simultaneously are challenged and needed in the face of that. The challenge is, if reason must address these things, are our creeds really as reasonable as they ought to be? So rationalistic challenges are going to come against the Reformed creeds. And they'll take on the form of Arminianism and Amiraldianism and other theological rivalries. We'll get into issues like supralapsarianism and infralapsarianism, logical analyses of the Reformed faith, and we'll talk about those all briefly. They kind of fall in this area, but start moving us into the post-Reformation age. But I think the thing that we ought to see then is that, on the other hand, in the face of reason, the creeds also become very important, because reason, unbridled, becomes very dangerous. It's, as Luther said, reason is a whore. Okay, reason can bed down with any worldview and argue its case. Reason can advance the gospel. It can advance atheism. And so we look at Cartesianism, Rene Descartes' epistemology, and it's viewed as really an atheism because it doesn't start with God. If it's not a true atheism, it's at least a practical atheism. It starts off as this: God is irrelevant. I don't need him to get started. Now, Descartes will bring God in along on the basis of the ontological argument. Having gotten himself in existence and having self-assertions, he'll need someone to give him some certainty beyond himself. And he will say, I demonstrated God's existence. I can imagine the most perfect being. Remember the ontological argument of Anselm? The most perfect being that I only imagine and doesn't exist is not the most perfect being. The most perfect being is one that has existence along with perfection. And therefore, he exists. Well, now that I have the most perfect being, and of course I started on my own and I found him, on the basis of that reality of God, I can be fairly confident that what's outside of myself is somehow knowable through my imperfect empirical observations and my very reliable rational analyses. And on the basis of that, rationalism is born. Okay, God is secondary, self-autonomy. Well, what do you do in the face of that kind of thinking? Well, your creeds, again, are now valuable against a new foe. The old foe was Roman Catholicism, the Anabaptist Radical Reformation. The new foe is rationalism, and the creeds are a defense against that because they say, no, we must, I think, therefore I am, is one worldview, but another is, I believe in order that I might understand. That's Augustinianism. It's going back to that classical model. I begin with faith, and on the basis of my faith, I try to make sense of my world. And as I make sense of my world with my creeds, I look at your viewpoint and I find it outside. And we can't go that direction. So the creedal model will then become the basis of a new war, the war within the church against reason that has somehow been developed to try to solve the problems that was created by the conflict between creeds. So what we're seeing here is that man is a very helpless creature. There are problems with creeds. There are problems if you don't have creeds. You know, they're necessary evils. They're blessings and burdens all at the same time. We can't live without them. And if we have them, we get into trouble. So what do? I can't solve the problem. You try to solve it. Okay? That's part of your solution. I think what we want to look at first, and what are the internal rivalries then within the creeds? We see here's this late Reformation problem. One of the first things within the Reformed setting then will be the challenge of Arminianism. Again, there's a wonderful whole story to be told as to how the Synod of Dort comes into being historically, but I don't want to go into all those details in this type of a survey class. But let me simply say it was enough of a significant movement that it not only involved the government of the Netherlands, because it was officially a reformed nation, but it involved political theories as to how they would deal with the crisis. Some of the contestants that were involved were, in fact, theological statesmen, theological attorneys. They were both political leaders and theological leaders simultaneously. And one of the great discussions is the debate of Arminius hit Reformed theology is, how will we solve this problem? One solution that was favored by the Arminians, Jacob Arminius is the man who for whom the Arminians are named, it breaks out the same time as the first year of the 30-year war, 1618. So there's the theological rivalry within, even as there is the theological war outside. So there's a simultaneous war going on for theology. And the issue of the Arminians was, let each state decide the issue in the Netherlands. You've heard of states' rights? That's an American phrase. Well, that was also a phrase from the Netherlands. Let the local states within the Netherlands in this commonwealth of states decide what they will do with this theological issue. There were others who were more on the Calvinistic side who said, no, this is a national issue, that we shouldn't allow each state to decide what we will do with Arminian teaching, but rather let's solve it on a national level. Well, the national level won out, and so therefore a synod was called, the Synod of Dort. And the people that caused the movement to take place, the Arminian controversialists here, challenged that whole idea with what was called a remonstrance. They protested with a remonstrance that's against the idea of having a national council that would somehow solve theological problems. They felt that the issues would be best dealt with on a local level in each state, in each church, in each synod, rather than trying to solve it from the top. Well, that gave it its name, the Remonstrance Controversy. Okay, that's another name for the Arminian controversy. Now, you probably are familiar with the 5 points of Calvinism. They basically address 5 theological issues that Jacob Arminius, along with his followers at high levels of Dutch government, brought into this debate that came to the national level. The basic issues were, how fallen is man? Does he have any free will or not? Does he have the ability to choose? You'll remember that this was a debated point in the Reformation itself. Luther had written The Bondage of the Will over against Erasmus's work. Later, we'll discover that Melanchthon will develop a synergism, kind of a modified bondage of the will. A lot of sin, but still a little bit of human ability. His view was is that man gives one penny toward the debt of $1 million. Not much, but he does act in will to choose the gospel. Luther said man is like a block of wood or a rock And they can only fall or be still unless an outward force moves them. Faith has to be a gift of God. We know where Calvin stood on the inability of man in sin. Well, here they argued that there is some ability. One of Arminius's ideas was conditional election. Why is it that some people are chosen and others are not in the gospel? And his viewpoint was that there was a conditional election, that God chose those to faith that he had seen through his omniscience would in fact receive the gospel. In other words, it is not a divine sovereign act that enables man to come to faith because God has chosen them first, but rather God freely, exercising his own omniscience, knows who will believe, and therefore he grants faith and grace and his choice to those who already would have chosen. So man's faith and action is prior and the basis of God's choice. There is an election, but it is a conditioned election. It is conditioned upon a foreknown act of faith in the creature. Okay? For whom did Christ die? He died for everyone. Some would have even argued that he died for Satan himself. He died for all creatures, not to redeem them in a sovereign way, but to make salvation available to all. Okay? The Holy Spirit's work, yes, it is powerful, but it can be resisted and is resisted by many unto their damnation. It does not overcome faith. It does not create faith. But the Holy Spirit's work of grace is engages the sinner who cooperates with grace. So it is synergistic instead of monergistic, a working together. And then finally, most people think the Arminians said you could lose your salvation. They actually did not teach that at the beginning of the controversy. In the Remonstrance controversy, they actually said, we are not sure whether a man can lose his salvation or not. They said it is possible that it might, but we don't know. The later Arminians came to the conclusion, you can lose your salvation. So that's a development within Arminianism. Okay? So these points are the issues that will be presented to the Synod of Dort, the National Conference. And they will make a decision that will represent a nation and a church. And when they make that decision, therefore, it will have not only the power of a church to discipline its body, but the coercive power of government to coerce its people to yield to that standard, because it's a church state. It's the Dutch Reformed Church. Now, what's significant is that we are living in a time when people had come to realize that the Netherlands was a place of very influential thought. We don't tend to think of the Netherlands as being one of the world intellectual centers. We still talk about The Hague and a few other things that go on there. But at this time in history, some of the greatest intellectual schools were in the Netherlands. They had attained very high-level work, and they had given some academic freedom. So you had men like Descartes who could investigate new thought within the freedom of some of these schools. All right, so the idea is that people were paying attention to the controversy in the Netherlands. And therefore, as the synod was called, it will become more than just a national synod. It will be international. We will have people coming from England. There will be people from Switzerland. There will be people from some of the war-torn countries where the 30-year wars are going to take out, from various parts, like the Palatinate, which is part of the reformed portion of Germany and the Rhineland. They will come. And so it will be an international conference. And what will be the issue? The issue is, do we accept the rationalistic explanation of salvation that Arminius has offered? Arminius is trying to make the gospel logical. He's not basing his position entirely on simply scriptural exegesis, and we'll show this in the following way. Arminius wants to say, well, what do we do with this difficulty of sovereign election? And after all, sovereign election is a difficult doctrine, that God would choose some and not all. Why would God do that? Doesn't the answer, well, he knew who would believe and he simply chose them, justify God very nicely? If you want to make God seemingly just, that's an easy answer. The only problem is it was noted and debated with Arminius that Paul could have used that argument in Romans 9 through 11 to answer God's choice. Who are you, O man, to ask this of God is what Paul says. It's not, well, it's a good question. And God did it because he knew you'd believe. Paul never says that. He says, don't you know that the potter has the right over the clay to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor? Paul undergirds the sovereignty of God. He does not give a good rational explanation for God's act. He simply says, God is God. Who are you, O man, to ask this of the sovereign one? Okay, so the point is that there is a rationalistic tendency under Arminius. Doesn't it make sense that man would cooperate? I mean, we make choices all the time. Wouldn't we cooperate with God and choose the gospel? The fact that God must do this work doesn't seem that rational or logical. It takes away something from it. So there are rationalistic implications that are at work in the Arminian controversy. And we might say that one of the issues that's going on now is that how will we make sense of our creeds, of our theology? And the Arminian position will be, well, we must give more room to man and take some away from God for our doctrines to make sense. And this will continue to work out in a couple ways. A wonderful theologian who's in the Arminian camp is a man named Hugo Grotius. His writings on some of his theology will actually be done behind bars. G-R-O-T-I-U-S is how you spell Grotius. Grotius, or Grotius, depending how you'd say his name, was the developer of a new theory of the atonement. Up to this point, there was the theory that the atonement worked in the reformational sense by penal substitution. That Christ was the Lamb of God who took the place of sinners, and God poured out his wrath upon this one so that his holy nature might be appeased. That's the Anselmic commercial view of the atonement, developed more fully with exegetical notions of sacrifice. And that was the reformational model of how the cross works. One of the problems with that viewpoint for an Arminian was, but if Christ was truly the substitute, if he really took the place of the sinner and God's wrath was poured out upon him, then how could God be just to punish anyone if he really had satisfied his wrath in a substitute and that atonement was universal in intent? Okay? If Christ died for everyone without exception and God really satisfied his wrath in this one, then how come anyone is lost? Must we not hold to universalism? Well, the Arminians were not universalists, but they felt the logical tension with their system. And what I'm suggesting is that they were trying to make sense of it. And Grotius, a legal scholar, theologian, said, we don't understand how the cross really works. He developed what became known as the governmental theory of the atonement. That God is the governor of his kingdom had to address the reality of sin. And he chose to do it in this way. But there was no intent for there to be a one-to-one correspondence with the people for whom he died. It was simply God as governor saying, I do take sin seriously. And that as the leader of my kingdom, I've addressed sin by showing you what sin deserves. Look at Christ, what he's done. But it is not a substitutionary penal satisfaction. So there is a rationalistic shift in the theory of the atonement. By the way, that is one of the problems that our evangelical Arminians have to live with to this day. If you are an Arminian, and some of you might be here, who say, I believe in an unlimited atonement, but you hold to a classic Protestant view of the atonement, of penal substitution, you have an interesting logical tension on your hands, and that is, then why are not all saved? And ultimately, we will find some Reformed people who will become believers in the universal extent of the atonement, and they will be, in fact, universalists, and that will come to pass. They'll say Christ really saved everybody. An example of that would be Benjamin Rush here in Philadelphia in the early colonial years. Yes? I think if you want a really good scholar, I don't know how quick it is, but a good scholarly treatment would be Dr. Godfrey's dissertation that he did many years ago. He's the president now of Westminster West. He did his doctoral studies on the Arminian controversy. And that would be an excellent source. I'm confident that he's really handled the details very well. So you might want to look there as a good place to review. I would say the following. Bettner is not a historian as much as a theologian. He's arguing his case. And when he does his theology, he's doing it very much as an apologetical theologian. He wants to make his case, which is fine. We need that kind of writing. Every system needs an advocate for its view. He's not an able historian in the best sense of that word. I think he's trying to make his case. And therefore, I would say, don't use him as the definitive word on the historical questions. See him as a great popularizer of key theological issues. And so he's very useful in sharing his writing, but I would not call him as a historian. I'd call him much more of an apologetical theologian. He's trying to argue a case. So he's like an attorney. He's taking a case to the court of public opinion and making the best lawyers are not the best historians. They'll bend the facts a little bit to make their point, or they'll play fast and loose with facts sometimes because they aren't important to them. They're getting to the bottom line. And apologists use history that way. They have an end they want to get to. So more careful history is needed. So don't use him as your historical source. Use him as your introducer to the concept and to make a good case. But if you really want to get into the historical nuances, that's not the place to go. I'm suggesting one good scholarly source. Godfrey would be a good first one place to begin. Okay, and he has a great bibliography there that will lead you to many other historical sources as well. Well, the point is he was saying that God has chosen to deal with sin, and this is how he's dealt with sin. He showed that sin must be, and Christ has done it. But he does not say that any more than a governor who wants to pardon his people of something has to make sure that every specific act has something that has addressed it in particular. He says, this is what I've chosen to use to address the satisfaction or to deal with the crime in this particular way. So he removes the notion of one-to-one correspondence, but he does not remove the notion of God's justice. God's justice and his wrath toward sin is shown, but it is not directly aimed at any one specific person or one specific sin, and therefore it shows us that God has forgiven sin in Christ, and it's intended for everyone, but not in an effective kind of way, but it's made there obvious that God has dealt with sin. Now, how do you deal with the specific text? Well, I've not gone into the exegesis of how Grotius does that. That would be a fascinating study. I'm just trying to capture his notion. Okay. Now, just so you know a little more about Grotius, he is called by many the father of international law. He was very interested in how does the law of nations work out. You've heard of the laws of nations. And the whole idea of international law, you think of the Netherlands as one of the places where nations come together when they have international legal conflicts. And that's stemming from that ancient heritage of the late Reformation period with Grotius. His classic work was done on the law of prizes. There was apparently a ship that was abandoned on the high seas. The storm, whatever was going on, was so severe that everyone just let it go. And they found another, they took a smaller craft and said, we'll never get this big ship back in. And they rowed out and the ship just went out and didn't sink. It's filled with all of its cargo. And someone found it on the high seas intact and claimed it, said it's ours. And the question was, but this was from another country than the one who found it. So the question, whose law governs on the high seas? Fascinating question. Is there a law? So maritime law, the law of nations in international waters, was something that Hugo Grotius developed. So when he talks about governmental theories, you see, he was a governmental theorist, and he's moving in that arena. And what is fascinating, and we would, I think, if you're Reformed, you tend to look at Arminians with a jaundiced eye. You know, you say, well, you really don't like what they had to say. But you do need to appreciate the fact that when he develops his theory of the law of nations, it's intensively biblical in character. He's trying to wrestle with Scripture and the whole notion of how does God's law work among nations. So you may not like his Arminianism, but you may be quite impressed with his commitment to the Scriptures. So remember that you can have a theological opponent who still may very, very much be an ally in certain ways. And I would think if you are looking for how law and government work together, you need to look at Grotius. He is a classic writer. And by the way, the stuff I'm telling you right now, most people in political science don't even know this. You know, people who are majoring in political science don't know the theological underpinnings of their discipline. You know something that you'll go to a PhD in political science, you'll know nothing of Grotius. You say, oh, I've heard about him somewhere. Well, you know more about them now than most do. It's a rare person that knows anything about the early history of these ideas. So the Reformation was bringing to bear the biblical authority through an Arminian, yes, but biblical authority on international law questions. So there's a fascinating area for someone to pursue. You might find that interesting. Okay. At any rate, what we need to see then is that the conflict between the Arminians and the Calvinists created an international conflict in terms of theology. How does different Reformed creeds now come together to answer a question, since Arminius' teaching challenges the theology of the French Reformed Church, the theology of the Dutch Reformed Church, the Reformed people, that the Westminster Assembly hadn't met yet, but people who are Reformed in the Knoxian tradition, they all had interest in this. So it brings together an international discussion, and that is part of the question of, now, how do creeds work? Well, they write a new creed. They have to address the issue. It's an international ecumenical Reformed Assembly called the Synod of Dort, and they'll address the theology of Jacob Arminius. And the Arminians ultimately will end up in jail. Okay, that's the way the church-state relationship. Grotius will write some of his work behind bars, along with others. Now, before I go any farther, maybe it's important that you remember there's a difference between an Arminian and an Armenian. Okay, do you know that? You can be an Armenian and be a good Calvinist. You can't be an Arminian and be a good Calvinist. Armenia is the country that's very close to Mount Ararat, historically. And if you ever go to Jerusalem, you'll actually find the city is divided into quadrants. There's the Jewish section, there's the Muslim section, the Christian section, and the Armenian quarter, these quarters. And Armenia is an ancient people and allegedly the first nation to become Christian as a nation about the year 300. And they've had a long historic standing as a people group in Jerusalem. And they are a distinct kind of ancient order from the Roman Catholic and Greek Orthodox, although they tend to be in the Orthodox pale. Okay, so Armenians are probably Arminian theologically. They would tend to not have sovereign grace teaching, but they're not Arminian. So just that's for accuracy in your mind. All right, at any rate, by the way, you can always tell an Armenian monk because he has a pointed cowl. They say that suggests they're coming from outside Mount Ararat. That represents that high mountain where the Ark lodged. Okay. At any rate, now, what happens then? The Ecumenical Reform Council gathers together. They're dealing with this assault against the Reformed creeds in these different five areas, and they develop the classic TULIP. Now, the TULIP doesn't work except in English. And I'm assuming you know what the TULIP stands for since you're a student at Westminster. You must have heard that by now, so I won't go through that. But as you think about that, it's important to realize that that's not the order that the canons were given in. And again, if you have never read the canons of the Synod of Dort, you must read them. It's on your must-reading list. Make sure you read them at least once. And when you read them, make sure you get both the positive statement and the rejection of errors. When they do their creed, they not only say positively what they teach, but they also say this is what we reject. And so it becomes a very precise type of confessing. It is both positive and negative in character. One of the things that I find very powerful about the Synod of Dort and its canons is that it takes the offer of the gospel very, very seriously. It talks about how the gospel is to be preached to men. And it actually quotes John 3:16 in the context of the Synod of Dort. You think that's an Arminian verse, right? No, that's a good Reformed verse. It wants to say that we must preach the gospel to the world. We want to get the message out. And that it takes a position that views election in light of man as fallen. And therefore, I would argue that it reflects an infralapsarian viewpoint. Okay, now let's define those terms. Because one of the great debates of the rationalism that's impacting everybody. We're trying to do theology. We're trying to bring different creeds together. We're trying to address the rationalisms of the Arminians. Well, the Reform system has some rational questions too. And the question that they're trying to answer is, how do we order the decrees of God? Now, what in the world do we mean by decrees? God's eternal plan in his own mind. Can we figure out what logical order he gave? Now, we can't say temporal. Okay, temporal is impossible applied to something that's eternal. But is there a logical structure? Now, you need to step back and say, can we even make the distinction between logic and time like this with God? Is it possible to do that? Well, is this a scholasticism, a rationalism that's invading the Reformed camp? Well, there's going to be a man who will say that, and his name will be Moses Amyrou. Amyrault, a French Reformed theologian who will say, you are becoming Protestant Roman Catholic scholastics. You're trying to go back to medieval scholasticism, making a distinction between time and logic. You can't do this kind of stuff. He said, and further, you're trying to pry into the mind of God. You can't pry into God's mind. God's mind is unknown to you. And do you know what theologian he will claim to establish his point? John Calvin. You say, I'm quoting Calvin. Calvin doesn't want us to invent these kind of theological structures. Okay, so Moses Amiro will develop a system called Amiraldianism, Amyraldianism, Amiraldianism. And this will now become what we call four-point Calvinism. Okay, Amiraldianism is going to argue for a universal atonement that is not effective. Not a universalism, it will be called a hypothetical universalism. And Amiro is going to be one of those who looks at the theology of Dort and says, don't try to order the decrees in the way you're trying to do it. But he himself will in some measure order the decrees anyway because he feels he has to. Okay, so let's talk about the ordering of the decrees and I'll try to define each of these systems. Let's write them on the board because I think it's easier to keep track of all these nuances here. We have, first of all, the language of supra lapsarianism. And you can see from the word supra, it means above. The word lapse means the fall. And the idea is, at what point in the logical order of God's decrees did God make the choice of choosing a people for redemption? Did he make it above the fall or under the fall? So that in the supralapsarian viewpoint, and one of the men who would have held this at the Synod of Dort was Gomarus. He would have been one of the leaders. I think he was the prolocator. I forgot how you pronounce that word. The key spokesman, at the kind of like the moderator of the Synod of Dort. He would have been a supralapsarian. And the order would be something like this. God elects. And also, God reprobates. You could make that one or two, however you want to order them. But the point is, God makes a choice to choose a people for himself, and he also determines to condemn some of his creatures for his own glory. God's election and God's reprobation is an act of his own glory, of absolute sovereignty. Why is it supralapsarian? Because he will determine that to permit them to fall. Okay, so the idea, I won't put all the order here, but to get the point is, God's choice is above the decree to permit the fall. Now in this system, there's a logical component. Again, I want you to feel the rationalism that everyone is starting to play with as they do their theology, they do their science, they do their governance. It is what is last in execution is first in intention. In other words, when we go about to do something, the last thing that we do was the first thing we decided to do. In other words, where you begin in your thought is where you end in your action. So that's the logical order. God's last act is to redeem the elect. His first act was to choose them for himself. His last act is to condemn the reprobate. His first act was to determine they would be lost. Now that's sovereign grace theology. In the most dramatic way, emphasizes the sovereign character of God and his glory. Now, in this debate, there were others who were fully reformed in their thinking who developed what became known as infralapsarianism. Okay? Infra meaning below. And so the notion here now is something like this, that God, first of all, determines to create. Having created, he determines to permit or cause, depending what sovereign language you want to use, to permit the fall. And then having permitted the fall, he chooses out of the fallen, the elect, and he reprobates the non-elect. He determines their judgment. Now, in this system of logical ordering of the decrees, the whole notion is that God makes his choice under the decree for the fall. So it's infralapsarianism. Okay, the logical ordering here. Why is this important? Well, the consideration that they had is that this is not only sovereign because it's pretemporal, but it's also just. because it takes into account man's fallenness before God. This emphasizes God's absolute sovereignty, but it leaves open the question, is this just? Now, God does whatever God does is just. But it does seem difficult, doesn't it, when you say, well, but these people that God has in mind are not only not created in His mind, He's not even determined to create them in the fullest sense, but they haven't even fallen, and they're already destined for judgment. How can that be just? That's kind of the retort. Now, as we stop and look at this, this is fairly difficult theology to find in the Scriptures. Is there any passage that tells us how to order the decrees? Now, you can go to texts that might give us implications. Okay, and there are many who've argued exegetically. Well, you can get, be that as it may, you can see the point is that there is a rationalistic movement in Reformed theology. So we begin to get the discussion of what has been called Reformed scholasticism. Okay, one of the impacts of the late Reformation era is the need to construct not only a systematic theology, but one that somehow uses the power of reason to answer important questions that may not be directly addressed by the Bible. Now, that gets us into the danger of what happened in the medieval period, scholastic theology. Now, is Reformed scholasticism bad? That's for you to decide, but there's going to be a debate that Reformed scholasticism causes. Let me just say that next word, and then we'll come back and talk more about decretalism in our next hour. The basic response to this is going to be covenantal theology. Covenant theology, in a certain sense, is going to say this method is inappropriate. Covenant theology says we must keep history of revelation primary, not logical deductions primary in our theology. And so you're going to get the school of Johannes Coxeus, a Dutchman, in the wake of the Synod of Dort, will develop a very important form of biblical historical theology in a covenantal form, where he's saying, let us not work so much with the hidden decrees of God's mind, but instead let's look at Revelation and work this out in the history of God's unfolding of His will. And that will be a reaction along with the Amiraldianism, which we've mentioned earlier, and we'll chart that out too. So let's take our break. We'll come back in 5 minutes.